On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Doctors are driven by a passion to save lives, but their earliest training ground is a room full of death. It's the Human Anatomy Lab, where cadavers are the constant companions of these students of medicine. Into this hidden realm comes a 28-year-old poet who yearns to be a doctor. Her story melds science with emotion, wrestles with the ethics of medicine, and recounts the long history of how doctors have turned to the dead to unlock the secrets of life. Up next, On Point, the making of a doctor, one cadaver at a time. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Christine Montross, a psychiatrist in training at Brown University. She's also a published poet. She wrote about the emotional bond that she formed with a cadaver in a new book called Body of Work, Meditations of Mortality from the Human Anatomy Lab. So great to have you with us here, Dr. Montross.
I'm delighted to be here, Jane. Thank you.
Well, you begin your book at the first week of medical school. Here you are, brand new. And the syllabus says, pick up a box of bones and so begin your journey.
That's exactly right. So having gone from someone who just, you know, like any other non-doctor, all of a sudden we're expected to walk into the anatomy lab, pick up a box that looks a great deal like a wooden suitcase and carry home with us a box of human bones. And I found myself as I was leaving the biomedical center walking with this box of bones to my car thinking, I am walking with two-thirds of a human body in this box and no one knows it. That was the beginning of that surreal experience.
In fact, you even wrestle, do I put the box in the front seat? Is it okay to put it in the trunk?
Yeah.
These sorts of things are going through your mind.
I think, you know, it prompts very strange moments. And you think, this used to be a person. Can I put a person in the trunk? So it brings up questions about identity.
And so not long after, there you are. You end up at the anatomy lab. You are a nervous first-year medical student. And what were you anticipating starting this incredible procedure?
Yeah, I think every medical student understands that the universal first experience is cadaveric dissection, and it's something that non-doctors and doctors know about alike, and it has a lot of mystique to it. But there's something mythical and exciting about it when you're far away from it, and then when it's the morning that you're expected to do that, I was pretty nervous to start.
So describe what it's like to walk into a room with 20 stiff corpses in bags stacked on steel tables.
That's right. There are these stainless steel tables, and we walk in, and the bodies are zipped into body bags. And, you know, I think in our culture today, where we actually have quite a distancing from death, it's not as it used to be, where loved ones are dying in the home, where family members prepare the body for burial. We may not even see a dead body. If we do, it's been embalmed and made up often, so the body looks like a living body. So to walk into a room full of dead bodies, I think for many of the students, it was the first time ever being around a dead person. Mm. And then the thought, not only are you in a room with dead bodies, but in a moment, you're actually going to cut into them. That makes the heart beat a little more quickly.
And so there you are with your three lab partners. And here is this body, this corpse, hands, head, and feet, they're covered. To what, depersonalize her?
Yeah, so that serves dual functions. I think the pragmatic and practical function that was explained to us was that these are areas of the body that are especially prone to drying out. And when one is supposed to undergo dissection, you need those body parts to stay pliable and not dry. But also, I think that there was an element of it that allowed us to proceed forward without seeing these parts that were so obviously connected with the humanity of these individuals.
And you see this, and you feel like what?
Nervous, shocked, excited, aware that this is the beginning of a journey. And also, I think there's this overwhelming sense of appreciation of the gift of donorship, that here's a total stranger who has offered to me her body, that I might learn from it on my journey to hopefully healing others. And it's a profound sense of gratitude, I think, as well.
You said in your book you were humbled by her sacrifice to donate her body to science. And
and at the same time fascinated by the strange, unsettling beauty of this human form.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an enormous act for someone to undertake.
And at that point, you felt that you needed to name her.
Yes and no. I think I'd heard stories about medical students for generations naming their cadavers. And at the moment that I walked into lab, I thought, you know, that seems pretty disrespectful. And I can't really imagine myself getting to a place where I would give a nickname to this cadaver. And as the semester wore on, the moment that actually did occur for our lab table, and the moment it did, just ended up being this organic, perfect moment where we uncovered the abdomen of our cadaver to prepare for the abdominal dissection, and she had no belly button. And we looked at each other and didn't know much about anatomy, but knew enough that everyone should have a belly button. And we sort of quietly looked at each other, and one of my lab partners turned to us. He said, "Well, maybe we got Eve." And I think that idea of, it was a funny moment, but it also came to really symbolize, you know, a first woman, a great teacher, someone who symbolized forbidden knowledge in the pursuit of knowledge, which, you know, cadaveric dissection was something that was legally and religiously forbidden for decades and centuries. And so it came to be a name that, rather than resisting, I really embraced, and I thought that it suited her very well.
So here is Eve. Would you read about her, a section from your book?
I'd love to, Jane. Thanks. Eve's body resonates more profoundly with me because I know that she is on the stainless steel table of her own choosing. And yet the simple decision allows me to make her into the type of person I imagine would choose such a thing. Educated, opinionated, concerned with the greater good, unsentimental, rational. Of course, the reality is that some of these things could be true of Eve, or all of them could, or none. But Eve's own agency in her dissection more easily allows me to assign her the traits I imagine a woman of her age would need in order to decide to donate her body to this kind of fate. The fact that the decision was hers, and that it is a special kind of decision that requires a sort of chutzpah, makes it easier for me to think of her as someone like my grandmother. It makes it easier to think of her as someone not so different from the way I see myself.
So in many ways, you're drawn to her. You see yourself in her. And yet in your book, you talk about this balancing act as a medical student between feeling empathy for her and being drawn to her and feeling that you need to be detached from her.
Right. And I think this is, you know, people speak about one's cadaver as the first patient that a doctor has. And I think that Anatomy Lab is a place to start to learn that lesson of balancing empathy and detachment. And we've all been in situations where we've been with doctors who are overly detached from us, where we feel as though they're too wrapped up in the science, too wrapped up in the diagnosis, and they're not feeling the very real feelings that go along with sickness and injury and health. So it's not the right thing for a doctor to go too far from the emotions of the patient. On the other hand, I know about myself that I'm someone who might be apt to go overboard in the other direction and empathize too strongly with patients. And, you know, that's not helpful either. In a moment where a family's in crisis, if I'm wrapped up in their issues and crying myself, that's not making me a helpful provider to them to guide them through what's a crisis for them. And so I think the body provides that balancing act for us as we're learning to balance our emotions in the anatomy lab.
And in the midst of balancing those emotions, you actually begin your work on Eve.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, beginning to cut into the body and feeling the emotions that brings up for us, reconciling the thoughts that it raises about mortality and doing harm to a body, and also understanding that for the greater good and for learning how to, you know, we dismantle the body in the hopes of making others whole at some point.
And you write with extraordinary beauty in this book, I must say.
Thank you.
That you write of taking her hand, and you say, in order to remove the skin from the hand, we must by necessity hold the hand in ours, mm-hmm. an intimate and familiar gesture that makes the directive to take a blade to the skin all the more unsettling.
Yeah, I think that Touching bodies is something that in life we do out of gentleness, out of affection, out of comforting, out of reassurance. And so there is an inherent incongruence within us when we are asked to do these previously unthinkable acts to
and
a
you,
body.
And you write, you say it was emotionally exhausting, emotionally tiring for you.
Medical school is emotionally tiring, but there's something particular about dissection where these emotional issues are raised and you're wrestling with them back and forth and aware of the feelings that it's bringing up within you that I think is an additional component that's pretty fatiguing.
I found it fascinating that you still dream to this day, most nights, of this very task.
Yeah, that has waned substantially over the years, but during the dissection, it was a very active part of my dream life, and I think that was true of many of my classmates, that we would come in, and it became sort of a bonding experience to share your dreams with your lab partners of, you know, the crazy body parts that were floating around in your dreams, and it's it doesn't make for a restful night's sleep, that's for sure, but those days have been left mostly behind me, which is nice.
We're talking with writer and doctor Christine Montross about her new book, Body of Work, Meditations of Mortality from the Human Anatomy Lab. Dr. Montross, you convey a real sense to me in your book that doctors are different, if only because of what they have done and what they have had to do in an anatomy lab. And yet you say there are days that you question whether you have a right to, quote, pursue wonder in seemingly inhumane ways. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think there are two parts to that question. One is, are doctors really different? And the answer to that, I think, is yes and no. No, in that, you know, doctors have the same human reactions that other people do to these kinds of circumstances. And yes, because they then have to modulate them to a certain degree. But the right to pursue wonder, you know, there would be these moments in the anatomy lab when you would cut into the human heart and see the tiny workings of the heart and watch how perfectly perfect the design appeared, and it just sort of takes your breath away. And then to remove yourself from that moment a little bit and say, but I've just cut into a woman, a dead woman, in order to allow this to emerge. And, you know, historically, we're in a fortunate position because these cadavers chose to have their bodies dissected, chose to have their bodies dissected by Brown medical students in our case. Historically, that was not at all the case. And lots of bodies were dissected against the will of people when they had been living. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a fraught past.
Mm. Will you read a little bit more from your book? This is a section of when you actually came to the conclusion of the dissection process.
This was at the end of the first day of dissection. There's a character here mentioned called Tripler. Tripler was my lab partner and became a good friend. When the first day of dissection comes to a close, Tripler and I head to our lockers. We chat absentmindedly, as if today is no different from any other day for us, as if we haven't touched our first dead body, cut it even, taken out its heart, and held it in our hands. Its heart. The it is what bothers me. Trip, I say. I just feel weird about the face, she says. Me too. We walk back to the lab door, fumble in our notes until we find the combination. We are the only ones in the room, and it is strange all over again. When we stand above our cadaver, as we have done for the last 6 hours, the room is silent. 20 bodies in the room, only we two breathing. It doesn't feel right to cut her up without knowing what she looked like before, I say. The reiteration is to buy time. We won't see what she looked like before, of course. She is shorn. She is the gray-green of formalin embalming. We can tell even through the cheesecloth, through the plastic bag, that her mouth is open. Still, she will look less herself by the time we are meant to take off the bag for the face dissection at the term's end. Trip nods. She is resolute. She unwraps a new blade for the scalpel and slides it onto the handle. She cuts the string that ties the bag over the head at the neck. I pull off the bag, unwrap the cloth. We hold our breath. The truth is, she is beautiful.
Hmm. Did you know anything about this woman's history, about her past, or is it just a body?
At the beginning of the dissection, we didn't know a thing. Toward the end of the semester, the teachers, the anatomy instructors we had revealed to us the age of each of our cadavers and their causes of death. So we learned those small tidbits. But and, you know, that varies in different schools and different cultures. There's some places where you know nothing about the body. There's some places where the names, the professions of the bodies are known. You know, there's some cultures in which one's expected to hold on to that name throughout your career in practicing medicine and be able to produce it on a moment's notice as someone who has contributed to your medical education.
Did the truth about what you found out about Eve match what you sort of had created in your mind about her?
She had died from breast cancer, and we knew that from the we knew that she had had breast cancer from the instant that we dissected her chest, and because we could obviously see cancerous tissue there. So we didn't know that that had been the cause of death at the time, but we certainly saw evidence of that disease.
You mentioned the history of cadavers. You've mentioned it a couple of times. You were affected by your experience so much with Eve that you set out to learn more about that and the study of anatomy. Tell us where your journey took you.
This was just such a fun part of writing the book, Jane. I started thinking a lot about the precedents that had gone before me in terms of anatomical dissection, that there were people who, you know, as we talked about before, really defied the edicts of popes and defied governments and artists and scientists who stole limbs from mortuaries and students who dug up bodies from graves and cemeteries. And I just was very interested in learning about that long line of dissectors that had come before me. So my partner Deborah and I went on the poor thing. I asked her if she wanted to come to Europe, and she thought, that sounds great. And then I took her on the creepiest tour of Europe imaginable, but we went to the wonderful anatomical theaters in Padua and Bologna, Italy. We went to a very strange hunt for relics in Rome, where we saw a crypt that was full of skeletons. And in Bologna, we saw the intact body of a saint. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to look at the kind of Renaissance collision of learning about bodies in the context of, you know, Catholic faith and governmental edicts. So it was terrific.
In your book, you also talk about where cadavers come from, country to country, which I found so fascinating. Maybe you could explain, as I mentioned, the country is sort of what is attached to that in Iraq, for example.
Yeah. So I have met a number of people from different countries who, when they learned that I was working on this project, were anxious to share with me their own experiences about dissection, and spoke with an Iraqi pathologist who said that all of the bodies in his anatomy lab were of Southeast Asian descent. None of them were Iraqi. So he didn't know if they were Cambodian or Thai or what, but they certainly had not come from Iraq. Spoke with a Nigerian pathologist who said that they were told that the bodies in Nigeria were criminals or paupers. And he said, you know, in a country where he feels as though the definition of criminal is a little too loose, that was really disconcerting to him. And I think one of the interesting things that I found is that had implications in the way that the students viewed the bodies. So if, as a student, you believe that the person that you're dissecting has been a cadaver, or has been a criminal, has been someone who has done evil things, you might be less apt to see the body in the respectful way that those of us who view our bodies as donors would do. So it has broad implications.
And the truth of the matter, even in this country, in the United States of America, you write, it's often the poor and the uninsured.
Historically, that was certainly true. That's not true any longer. Bodies are voluntarily donated. But historically, often prison populations, disproportionately African-American populations were dissected. Graves were certainly upturned and unearthed for bodies to be used for dissection.
Dr. Christine Montross is the author of a new book, Body of Work, Meditations on Mortality from the Human Anatomy Lab. So many callers lined up to
Terrific.
Speak with you and join the conversation. Alice is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice. You're on the
Hi,
line.
Jane. As I said, I'm a cadaver in waiting. I signed up in response to publicity about the need 30 years ago, and my motivation was to do one more thing for whatever as I went out, and also to avoid the funeral parlor scene and just to be active up to the very end.
So what is your intent, Alice? What do you hope that your body will glean?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I just like to think I'm contributing to the science of something and learning. I even asked my hairdresser to fix my hair so I'd go looking good, but he found it bad.
Well, we hope you live a lot longer than your 91 years so far. Alice, thanks for your call.
I think, and I can say to Alice, thank you on behalf of the people who will certainly learn from you in the future. That's an awfully generous gift.
Mm. Sandy is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Sandy, you're on the line. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just was calling because I sort of have two perspectives. One, my husband is a professor at a medical school, and also long before I ever even met him, both my parents had decided to donate their bodies to medical schools and have since done that. And I just wanted to give a sort of perspective of what was going through their mind when they made that decision.
And what was going through their minds?
Their feeling was that the reason we're on this earth is to help whenever we can, and they couldn't understand why everybody wouldn't do this because you were saving a life, in their view, that by teaching doctors, those doctors turn around and save others, and why in the world would they rot in the ground when they could be doing some good?
Mm-hmm. Sandy, thank you for your call.
Very clear cut.
Thank you.
And I think such an altruistic perspective to have. I mean, we're all aware of, family needs to mourn, family needs to grieve, there are rituals around our deaths, but to be able to look beyond that, I think I'm consistently just astonished that people are able to have that perspective that Sandy describes that her parents had, that they really felt as though it had, longitudinal effects, and that's certainly true.
Mm. Becoming a doctor was not always your dream. You had quite a path to this point. Can you take us back a little bit and tell us how you got here?
Sure, yeah. My partner always jokes that I was false advertising because when we met, I was a poet in a Master's of Fine Arts program, and she always says, you didn't have a pager when we met. You didn't get called in the middle of the night. And so that's true. I was a French major in college. I did master's work in poetry at the University of Michigan and then was teaching college and then high school writing classes, and had always been intellectually interested in mental illness. Had written a lot of poems about madness and sort of the philosophies behind madness and the lines between divinity and madness. And then I went out and taught high school in a public school in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the kids there were really troubled kids. Lots of them on legal probation. Many had been expelled from their public schools. And I began to see that mental illness and psychosocial issues were not just these philosophical, ideological things to toss about, but they had real impacts on kids' lives. Mm. And these children were really unable in many ways to succeed in the classroom because of some of the difficulties that they were experiencing in their homes and in their lives. So that for me kind of crystallized a desire to work in the mental health field. And I thought about psychology. I thought about social work. My mom's a psychiatric social worker, so I had a wonderful model for that. And in the end, just decided that psychiatry was a good fit for me.
And your first experience in that anatomy lab, I read it in many ways, solidified that interest in medicine and mental health.
In terms of
that being what you wanted to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, dissection certainly brings up, is in some ways a manifestation of some of the conflicts that we have between our emotions and our actions. And I think that it was just a rich environment for me to begin learning, and it didn't scare me away.
Mm. You mentioned the emotions and the actions. Mike is calling from Yorktown, Virginia, with a comment about that. Mike, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. How are you? I just had a comment. A long time ago, I was an emergency medical technician, and when I studied at the University of Tucson in Arizona, we got the opportunity to observe an autopsy. And I understand what she says about the detachment. You have to maintain a detachment, but you can't let it take your humanity and personality away. Mm-hmm. I even asked a woman out on a date during the autopsy just to, kind of maintain normal life during what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mike, thank you.
Yeah, I witnessed several autopsies during the writing of this book, and the first one that I saw, and an autopsy is very different than the anatomy lab, because the body is not embalmed. There are all kinds of sights and smells that go along with it. The blood mm-hmm. is still in the body. So for me, it was a pretty, it made me reel a little bit. But the anatomy technician, the autopsy technicians and the doctors were bantering back and forth, talking about their daughter's softball games, talking about what happened next. And the reality is, in many of these instances, it's work, and we all acclimate to our work environments. We become more and more comfortable in them. And yet, I do think what the caller says is correct, that you can't detach so far that you're not aware of the fact that you're in kind of a profound moment.
Can you tell what kind of doctor a person is going to be in that anatomy lab? Or does that experience change a person to become a better doctor generally?
I think there's some people who instantly, were going to be surgeons. They loved cutting. They loved unveiling. They, the action of it was really exciting for them. There were others, and, many of my fellow psychiatrists will probably see themselves in this category, where they were more comfortable, watching from afar. I think I was a little unusual in that regard, that as a psychiatrist-to-be, I was pretty comfortable doing the dissections. But you certainly get a sense that, it shakes down differently along specialty lines a little bit in lab.
You say you were comfortable during the process. Was anything difficult for you?
Oh, sure. Lots of things were difficult. When I say that, I mostly mean I think some people are more comfortable being the ones that are dissecting, and others are more comfortable hanging back a bit. And I got bored hanging back. Mm. But there's no question that, sawing into the skull, doing the pelvic dissection, and from that section that you read earlier, Jane, cutting into the hand, we all have such a visceral understanding of what it feels like to cut the skin on your palm. And so to perform that action on another body, those were difficult moments.
Mm. You say your medical training has put you in positions of both omnipotence and powerlessness.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of each?
Yeah, I had a mentor when I first started medical school. There was a fourth-year student that we were sort of paired with, who gave us some instructions about, this journey that we were on. And one of the things he said to me was, three things happen to you now that you've chosen to be a doctor. You cut and touch a dead body. You can walk into a room and ask someone socially inappropriate questions, and they will answer you. And you can ask someone to take off his or her clothes, and they'll do it. And that, those are three pretty powerful things. And I think there are things that we needed to keep in mind and be very cognizant of, that was a transformation that was taking place. Mm. And so that kind of omnipotence that needs to be very carefully wielded. And then on the other side, the powerlessness. I mean, you only need to work in a hospital for a few days to learn that we know so much about the body and disease, and yet there are some instances where we just don't know anything, or when life just takes its course and there's no cure or there's no solution, and that's a humbling experience for all of us.
I'm curious, did you mean for your book to be of value to patients?
I didn't think about that so much. When I started writing, it was mostly in response to friends and family members who had immediately said, once I started medical school, what is it like? What's the anatomical dissection like? What does it look like? What does it smell like? And so it started as just a way to allow people into that experience. We all have such intimate relationships with our bodies, and yet there's so little we know about the interior workings of the body. I had no idea what my spleen looked like before I started medical school. So it started as a way of sharing that. And then because I wrote it during my own journey through medical school and becoming a doctor, I think it just necessarily became about that path. And I think the results some people have told me has been that it allows them as patients to view differently the way that their doctors work. And I think that that's been a treat.
And how in the world did you have time to write a book in medical school and in residency?
Yeah, it's a juggle. As a working mother, Jane, that juggling is juggling. And I was in the lucky position of having been a writer before and not wanting to lose that part of myself when I entered into medicine. And the first 2 years of medical school are quite a lot of memorization and regurgitation. And I really longed for the kind of creative thinking and expression that writing afforded. So when I would have moments to write, I just stole them. And it was a rejuvenating experience for me. And it, you know, and I, it would be disingenuous to say also, I actually took a year off of medical school after my third year. My partner is a playwright, Deborah Salem Smith, and she won a Fulbright in playwriting and moved to Dublin, and I went with her. So I also had an entire year that I could devote just to reading and writing, and that was really instrumental in the process.
Let's invite some of our callers who are lined up on the line now into our conversation. Steve is calling from Nottingham, New Hampshire. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
And, hi.
Thank you, doctor. I'm actually a psychiatrist, so I have many experiences with the cadaver. And the first is I want to expiate myself from some of the guilt, because in certain ways when I was a medical student, which when the dinosaurs walked the earth, we were not very, very reverent to our cadaver. Uh-huh. We were appreciative, but we also, after working with this human being for many times, did things and took her for granted. And and to expiate my guilt, what I want to tell you is some really neat programs that are going on at Dartmouth Medical School and at least the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where at the end of the freshman year, there was a funeral service held for the cadaver, and the families of the cadavers come and the students, and they can all have, in a sense, a funeral and a formal goodbye and a thank you. Mm.
My goodness, Stephen, thank you for that.
I think that's not uncommon. I think that's increasingly done, and I think it's a terrific idea. And different schools handle it different ways. Some invite the families of the donors, and that's sort of a wonderful opportunity for the families to feel appreciated and to see firsthand the students that their loved one's life affected. And then some schools just have a moment for the students themselves to reflect and express themselves, and it's a great way to just pause for a moment and express that gratitude.
Peter is calling now from Providence, Rhode Island. Peter, hello to you.
Hello, Jane. Hello, doctor. My mother passed away about 15 years ago here in Providence, and her cadaver went to Brown University Medical School. And she was a pediatrician, and I think that she really wanted to make sure, while she was a doctor, and while she was alive, she was always interested in making sure the next generations of doctors were learning from her. And I think she saw that as a way to continue educating the next generation.
Interesting. Peter, thank you for your call. Carol is calling from Hampton, Virginia. Carol, hello to you.
Hi, Jane, and hi, Dr. Montrose.
Hello.
I donated my body, maybe about 10 years ago as an altruistic thing to do. The only thing recently, my family found out about it, and they said they would not do it. They would not, you know, they would not go along with my wishes. So I opted out of the program. After I opted out of the program, I found out that certain body parts are sold. It's probably a legitimate organization that does this. What are the guidelines, and is this true, that body parts are sold to different hospitals? Well, I'm not even sure where they go.
Well, Carol, we'll ask Dr. Montrose if she knows, doctor.
Yeah, I don't know the specific details that you're talking about. I do know that most university donation programs have very stringent guidelines about how the bodies are used, and certainly they're not out to make a profit on those. I can speak knowledgeably about the Brown program and say that I think it's not unusual that they are strictly devoted to educational purposes. And I just a comment in addition on the piece about family. I think that's a very real component of the decision. Family members are the ones who are left to do the grieving after one has died, and I think having the family members on board is an important part of the discussion when someone makes the decision to donate one's body. And the hope is that people would understand the intentions of the donor. But I do think in order to prevent family conflict afterwards, it's an important thing to discuss.
So the family members will trump the will of the person who's donating?
In certain instances, it can. can. You know, I spoke with a professor of anatomy, Clive Lee, in Ireland. And in Ireland, certainly, he said, you can will me your necklaces, you can will me your books, but you can't will me. We don't own our own bodies. So if your son or daughter comes in and says, no dice, then it's no dice. And, that may not be true here, but I do think just from a family communication standpoint, it's just important that people understand the decision.
Back to the book for just a moment. Besides what you describe in the anatomy lab, I thought some of the loveliest and most emotionally wrenching moments are in the hospital. You describe a man on a ventilator in the ICU, and there's a crayon drawing above his head, and I'd like you to read that from the book.
Yeah, this was a passage when it was my job as a medical student to change bandages on a man who was not conscious in the intensive care unit. So I'm talking about my care of him. And this goes on for 3 days, and I dread the chore of changing Mr. C's bandages. I enter his room, give falsely cheerful greetings, a cursory exam, and as quick a change of gauze as I can manage. On the fourth day, everything changes. Mr. C is in exactly the same condition. He is no better, no more coherent. His wounds are just as raw and infected. But when I enter, I see that marker drawings have been taped to the wall of his room. A photograph of a man, woman, and two elementary school-aged boys has been taped to the bed rail in a place where, if Mr. C would only open his eyes and turn his head, it would be directly in his field of vision. No matter how closely I look, I cannot believe that the grinning young father in the picture is Mr. C, the same man who looks so little like a man, so much less this man, and yet I know it to be true. On his headboard, in a childish crayon scrawl, is a paper sign that, intentionally or not, is unquestionably for me. In capital letters, it reads, "My daddy is going to make it. He promised me he would."
Then there's the experience that you write about having to tell a man that he is dying, and you break down and you can't do it.
And I think that, you know, this is exactly that balance that I'm talking about. I was given the chance to have this conversation with a family because I'd followed this patient throughout his hospital stay, and the oncologist that I was working with thought that I would be able to have the conversation with them, and I started to cry. And I think that, you know, when we were talking earlier about how to find that balance, the oncologist was wonderful, who I worked with, and he sort of gently stepped in front of me and began laying out for the family very kindly and compassionately, but laying out the real options that lay ahead of them and kind of steered them through their own grief to make a decision. And I realized in that moment, you know, one side of the balance is me not thinking ahead of time about this poor man and his children until I saw the crayon sign, and then that made me really understand his humanity, even though he looked inhuman in the ICU. On the other side of that balance is me not being able to guide a family through their moment of crisis without letting my own emotions get in the way. And I think somewhere in the middle is the balance that we all hope to strike as physicians.
Go to the phones again. Kate is now calling from Saranac Lake, New York. Kate, hi to you.
Hi, Jane. I have a comment and a question for the author. My mother died of ovarian cancer, and I wanted to donate her body to science, but she had said she wanted to be cremated and her ashes spread, so I didn't think I could do that. And then I found out later from a friend, he said that they had just received the ashes of his aunt who had donated her body to science, and her body then had been, the parts had been cremated and returned to the family for disposition. If I had known that that was possible, I would have donated my mother's body. So I think maybe people want to know that. Also, I would like to donate my own body. I have birth defects. I have donor parts. And, you know, I feel it's really important to educate the next generation of surgeons, having had good and bad doctors. But I'm a lawyer, and I have seen hundreds of wills, and I have no idea how to go about doing it. Does your author know how we would do that?
So again, speaking from my own experience at Brown, I know that there's someone at the medical school at Brown who takes these very calls and meets with people and informs them about the process. So I think the good starting point would be to choose an institution to which you'd like to contribute. And so if there's, you know, your alma mater or some place that you admire, and just contacting the medical school, without a doubt, there'll be someone there who's very knowledgeable who could talk with you about it. And I think the point that you raise is an important one. I know that the remains of the bodies that we dissected were offered to family members of the deceased. You know, if they wanted them cremated, we cremated them. If they wanted the ashes, they were entitled to the ashes. If they wanted them buried, they were buried. So I think that as much as possible, I think universities are mindful of the fact that families want to have a say in this.
Do you think, Dr. Montross, that we have some sort of strange fascination with pathology in this country? It seems there's a pathologist character which is central to some of the most popular shows on television, from CSI to Law and Order. What is it about that work that intrigues us?
Right. I mean, you're right on the nose, Jane, and I just feel as though, especially with these exhibits that are traveling through museums, are wildly popular, of dissected bodies and CSI and medical examiner shows and even Grey's Anatomy and ER. We just are innately curious about the body, and we're innately curious about the dead body. I think none of us can really wrap our minds around what happens to ourselves after we die. And so the process of decomposition in some of these crime shows, that's a harsh reality of what happens to us. But even some of these shows about the spirits of dead people visiting us and guiding us, you know, I think they're all part and parcel of the same thing, where we're wondering what happens to me and to those that I love after their body fails and dies. And I think in general, the answer is we're not really sure.
In the book, you write about when the anatomy class course is over, you return to the anatomy lab. And what happened?
It just felt important to me to, one of the callers spoke about having a ceremony, and we had had a little informal ceremony, but it felt important to me to say some kind of a farewell to Eve, who had become such a great teacher and such a foundation of my medical training. So I walked into the lab and unzipped bag after bag until I found her body, and just took her hand in mine and spent a minute there with her. And it was, I think it was important for me to take that time just as a thank you.
You write in the book that she gave you a gift, an unthinkable gift.
Right.
Which is?
She's a total stranger. I'm a total stranger. And she allowed me to perform this intimate and honestly destructive act on her body. And I think the callers that have called in to speak about loved ones or their own decisions to do this have that in mind, with full knowledge of the gift that it was. But to be on the receiving end of that gift was really a lucky experience.
This book seems to be a tribute in many ways to her.
I hope so. I hope so.
After your experience with Eve, are you going to be a donor to science?
This is a question that I get asked a lot, and I think, if I'm very honest, I don't know the answer to that question. Hearing some of the callers call in with the certainty in their voices, it just underscores the less certain that I have been about this, the more it has made me aware of the kind of attributes that one must have in order to make this decision. Because I feel as though I, of all people, should understand that this is something one should do. And yet I still have reservations. So it just, it has really emphasized for me the sheer altruism that that must be a part of that decision.
And what's the biggest reservation?
I don't know. I think it's nothing about how the body was treated. It's just, you have to be kind of gutsy to say, I'm going to have my naked body out on a plank and let people take it apart and pour into its insides. And I just have, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for people who are able to just without a thought say yes to that, and I hope that one day I might become one of them.
Dr. Christine Montrose has been our guest this hour, a poet, a former high school teacher, second-year resident in psychiatry at Brown University, and author of the book Body of Work, Meditations on Mortality from the Human Anatomy Lab. Great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it, Jane. Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.